Okay, so we are live. It is it's 12:31. You're exactly on time. We're going to go ahead.
For you, it is.
So thank you for spending time with us on this lovely evening, Erev Chag in Israel. I want to welcome everyone to this special APN briefing call with Danny Seideman calling us from Jerusalem. I'm Lara Friedman. I'm the Director of Policy and Government Relations here at Americans for Peace Now in Washington. We are here with Danny to talk today about some of the things that are happening with respect to Jerusalem and settlements. There's been a great deal in the news. I do want to mention that the sort of the context today, everyone is, you know, there's a lot in the news. If you look at the Israeli press, it's mostly about Gilad Shalit, which is sort of, you know, the first positive news point we've had in quite a while. I don't know if Danny sort of wants to talk about that as just the general mood in Israel these days and how people are feeling. But in addition, and one of the issues that didn't get a lot of coverage initially because of the Gilad Shalit story was some breaking news last week in terms of settlement activity in East Jerusalem, some significant news. So, Danny, why don't I turn it over to you here? I think you and I will chat for maybe 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll open it up to Q&A and try to get this done pretty close to an hour so you can celebrate
okay.
with your family.
Great. Where shall we start with Gilad Shalit?
Oh, let me take just a step back. I didn't introduce you because, of course, I assume everyone knows you. So we have with us today Danny Seideman, who is the expert on Jerusalem, recognized pretty much worldwide as knowing more about the issue of Jerusalem, related issues of, you know, two-state solution in Jerusalem, settlement, land confiscations, planning, zoning, all of that. Danny is known to a lot of you from his previous incarnation at an organization called Iramim, which he founded. A little over a year and a half ago, Danny created a new organization called Terrestrial Jerusalem, has a website, www.t-j.org.il, which has rather extraordinary mapping and other information on it. The resources are incredible. I highly recommend it. So with that now, Danny, I turn it over to you to start wherever you like.
Well, since you put me up to it, I will do what I don't usually like to do, and that is talk about non-Jerusalem issues. But these are indeed special days in Israel. Given the swap and the return of Gilad Shalit home, and I, very briefly, I'd give you my read on the mood at the moment or the developments. Number one, I think we should take a step back and wait to see how things play out. But I think we've seen three levels of this in Jerusalem, in Israel. One, there is a sense of exhilaration. There's a sense of relief. It's universal. And it reminds us of a humanistic Israel with a good deal of solidarity that we have loved in the past and we've seen too little of in the present. And there are a lot of Israelis who are relishing this moment, especially given this figure of Gilad Shalit, who is an anti-hero. But there's as much hero in the anti-hero as there is anti. He's delicate, he's frail. But there's something, there's tensile strength and integrity, and it's heartwarming. That's level one. Level two is the rancorous debate, whether this was right or not. Now, most of Israel is clearly in favor of this, and Netanyahu would not have gone for this had it been otherwise. But the fault lines are there, and there are people, many of them people who are our political opposition and the settlers, were saying this was a horrendous deal and this should not have been done. I think the cheap way out of this is saying, okay, this is the fault line in Israeli society between the settler crazies and normal people. That's not fair. The people who opposed this deal and the bereaved families who have lost loved ones to terror are making compelling arguments, and just beneath the surface of the euphoria of return of Gilad, this rancorous debate is cutting into us, and I think that we would be wise to pay close attention to this, not in ideological terms. And then the third discussion that's going on as a subtext is aren't we being a bit intrusive? Aren't we turning this human drama of an individual and his family into reality television? Aren't we a bit, postmodern and kitschy about this? There are elements. I know myself and friends of mine who basically said we've got to turn off the radio and put on earphones and listen to classical music because there's too much of this. But after all that, this is also a discussion that's going on in Israel, and there's a discussion as to how to strike the right balance between empathy and kitsch. So these are heady days. It'll take time for it to sort itself out, but these at the bottom line, these are days of celebration in Israel. It's good to see Gilad home.
All right, so now do you want to talk about Jerusalem?
I'd rather continue to talk about positive things, but the answer is that's not why you asked me to weigh in with you people. Bad things are happening. I met with the head of the Elad Settler organization a couple of weeks ago, and we joked with one another, you've got an anniversary. I said to him, I've got a yard site. It's 20 years now since I began to deal with Jerusalem issues to the day. It was October 9th, 10th of 1991 when I started to deal with this, when the settlers moved into Sivan. In the 20 years that I've covered this, and by the way, for those of you who don't know, Lara Friedman was the first diplomat I ever know because I ever met, because I met her in 1992 or 3, and when Lara was in her capacity in the State Department as a political officer at the consulate in Jerusalem. I hope I'm not giving too much away. In those 20 years, I have never seen such a surge of settlement activity as we are witnessing now. Now, sometimes when you get into the weeds in these issues, you're overwhelmed by events and you let emotions carry you away. No, we're talking about objective benchmarks. How many plans are being expedited at the moment? How many plans are there that were deposited within the last 2-3 months for public review, which is a significant step towards implementation? How many plans have been approved? And when you approve a plan, it means, tomorrow morning you can have new tenders. And I cracked the figures over the last few days, and it turns out we're talking about on the order of 8,000 additional units close to implementation, months away from possible implementation. Now, since 1967, Israel has built 51,000 units in East Jerusalem. That means at the moment there are more than 15% of the total number built since 1967 close to implementation. Since 1967, Israel has built barely 600 Palestinian homes for Palestinians with government support. In other words, in the pipeline at the moment, we are talking about 10, 12, 14, 15 times as many units in the last 2 or 3 months expedited that have been built in the last 44 years for Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And then you look at the overall context, and you look at where these plans are, and what the map will look like when they are built, and you understand, my Lord, we are close to a map that will be so balkanized geographically and demographically, there's no point about talking about the two-state solution because there's no line that can be drawn on that map, which will leave a viable Israel and a viable Palestine. Rather, there will be a colonial Israel and a cantonized Palestine with Nakusans. We are close to that. Now, I'm not speaking ideologically. I'm speaking as an amateur but accomplished cartographer. Can you draw a line on the map under foreseeable circumstances that will allow under any kind of circumstances, whether it's 6 months from now or 10 years from now, a political division of the land of Israel, which must be in Jerusalem, and we are 5 minutes to midnight.
All right. So can you maybe, just for the benefit of the people on this call who have not been reading the amazing things that you've been putting out on the website and maybe have missed some of the news of the past week, just talk a little bit about some of the things that have happened most recently and why they are either emblematic of how the Bibi government has been acting for a while or how they up the ante if they do.
Mm-hmm. Let me focus on an area that I've never focused on in the past, and that is the southern flank of Jerusalem. You know, I'm sure that there are a few stalwarts out there who will remember our efforts on E1, which is on the eastern flank, and our efforts in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah, which are in the city. I'm now looking at the border between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And within the last 3 or 4 months, there have been developments that are game changers. There are 2 plans which expand the existing footprint of Gilo in the direction of Beit Jala and Bethlehem and undermine the credibility of a political process. I've got a buddy, maybe he's listening out there, he's a Peace Now supporter, who once said to me, the debate over settlements is like 2 guys ordering a pizza. And the pizza comes and they start debating how to split the pizza, who gets the mushrooms, who gets the olives. But one side can eat the pizza and the other side can't. Well, we're changing the border between Israel and Palestine in Mordor Gilo, and that's on the order of 1,800, 2,000 units. Then we have the approval of the Har HaMaaseh plan, 1,000 units there, expanding the border between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, Israeli border, to the south. That changes the border. And finally, the most devastating one, which has not been widely publicized in Israel, but it's been widely publicized abroad. You folks probably know more about it than the Israeli public. We're focused on Gilad Shalit, and that's 2 Givat Matos plants. Givat Matos is in more or less an empty area to the on the southern flank of Jerusalem between Bethlehem and the Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Hatzafa. Now, the Givat Matos plans that have been deposited for public review or are coming up entail the creation of the first new Israeli neighborhood in East Jerusalem since Har HaChoma, which also, by the way, for those of you with short memories, was a production of Netanyahu, not Netanyahu the sequel, Netanyahu the original, his first term in office. Now, the Gilo plans make a two-state solution a bit more difficult, undermine the credibility of the process. The Givat Matos plans make a two-state solution almost impossible because they destroy contiguity or the possibility of contiguity between a Palestinian neighborhood, Beit Hatzafa, and the future Palestinian state. Now, I'm not sure that Beit Hatzafa is going to be in Palestine in a two-state solution. There may be other options, but that is what should be negotiated and negotiated in good faith. Now, I've mentioned 2 plans in Gilo, 2 plans in Givat Matos, and the possible tenders tomorrow morning in Har HaMaaseh. You don't see the map that I see in my mind's eye before me. These are pieces in a contiguous puzzle that will create a buffer between Bethlehem and East Jerusalem on Jerusalem's southern flank, in which the possibility of any serious border regime between a viable Palestinian state and an Israeli state go down the tubes. So, you know, know, for years I have usually tried to put things in measured tones because I knew the day would come where I'd have to cry wolf. I'm crying wolf. These plans will not take place tomorrow morning. Some of them might, like Har Chomasi, but they're not going to take place a year from now. And that means that we have to engage in getting these plans under control under dire circumstances. You can, you know, maybe we'll talk a bit about how the Netanyahu government is reacting to international intervention, including from Washington. But what I am describing is a compendium of plans that are creating critical mass that will significantly change the options available to Israelis and Palestinians in a way that will make the two-state solution pretty close to impossible.
Let me ask you one of the questions that I get asked a lot. What, when you talk about all these different kinds of approvals, what is the government of Israel role here in terms of, you know, responsibility? You know, does one say this is all Bibi, he's made a decision, every detail? Is it an overarching decision and people are acting on their own but knowing that they're supported? And can you kind of sketch out for us who is responsible here?
You know, there was a great comedy routine with Dudley Moore and others in Great Britain, I think it was probably the 1960s, called Fireside, I don't know what they were called, Beyond the Fringe. And in one of their routines, it was about the Great Train Robbery. And the interviewer is interviewing a police commander and says, sir, do you believe thieves to be responsible? And the response was, oh, I believe thieves to be terribly irresponsible. Who's responsible? It is the government of Israel that is responsible. A. Gilo, sponsored by the Jerusalem Development Authority, much on state land, not all of it, almost all of it. Jerusalem Development Authority is entirely controlled by the government of Israel. The Givat HaMatos plans were filed by the Israel Land Authority, an organ of the government of Israel, to the Ministry of Regional Planning Board, which is operates within the framework of the Ministry of Interior. Har Homa, state land, the plans approved were plans submitted jointly by the Ministry of Construction and the ILA. This is the government of Israel acting on these plans. They are responsible. Now, the second question comes from a whodunit. You know, do you believe thieves to be responsible? Now, I am of two minds on this, and I really must admit that I don't know. What I do know is the following. Between March 9th of 2000, when Vice President Biden, your Vice President, visited Israel and was greeted by 1,600 units in Ramat Shlomo, until November 1st of 2010, a seven-month period, there was a de facto settlement freeze in Jerusalem. That was a result of intervention by the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's office. In doing so, he laid to rest the question, can Netanyahu freeze settlements? We have scientific proof that he can. He did. On November 1st of last year, he very simply said, all restraints, said to the Israeli bureaucracy, previously in effect, are done. Man's got to do what a man's got to do. You are not limited by the Prime Minister to expedite any of these plans. There are two possible interpretations of this. One, that Netanyahu gave a blanket approval of settlement schemes. You need not consult me. There are advantages in this for me. What I don't know about in advance, I cannot be held accountable for. That means that Netanyahu does not know about these plans in advance because he has created a situation in which he need not know they can proceed. That is the more complementary interpretation. The less complementary interpretation is Netanyahu does not want to negotiate because it will erode his domestic political base. He wants to prevent negotiations from taking place, but under circumstances where he can place the blame on Abu Mazen. As a result of that, having strengthened Hamas with the Shalit deal, at the expense of Abu Mazen, he is driving additional nails into the coffin by engaging in provocative settlement activities in Jerusalem to further discredit him, because an emboldened Hamas is preferable to Netanyahu than an emboldened Abu Mazen. Abu Mazen entails the risk that Netanyahu will have to negotiate. The Hamas does not.
Okay, let me ask you one more question, then we can open this up to Q&A. On the issue of the building in Jerusalem, we saw not that long ago people in the street in Tel Aviv complaining about housing costs, and there is a housing crunch in Israel. To what extent does the sort of construction and planning that we're seeing in East Jerusalem, to what extent is it consistent with actual needs of Israel in Jerusalem, or is this entirely politically motivated?
Now, I can answer from a rather arcane place. In the past, we have pointed out two kinds of settlements. One, which are centrally managed and marketed by the government of Israel. Those are the large settlement neighborhoods in East Jerusalem and include all of the plans that I have mentioned until now, Gilo, Har Choma, East Talpiot, etc. Alongside of that, and there are about 195,000 Israelis who are living there. The second kind of plan are those that are motivated by nationalistic and messianic zeal. And there are 2,000, 2,500 settlers who live in places like Silwan, Sheikh Jarrah, the Muslim Quarter, Abu Tor, etc. That is the classic categorization. But we've witnessed two plans in recent years. A few hundred units in Nof Tzion and Jabal Mukaber, and about 66 units nearby in Sawakhra, East Talpiot, which are driven by purely economic motivation. They're not supported by the government, and they're not driven by messianic zeal. Both of them are in trouble. One is going bankrupt. One is, it may be purchased by a Palestinian. My conclusion from this is that were market forces alone involved in settlement activities in East Jerusalem, Israelis would not build and would not move into East Jerusalem. It is only massive government support on the one hand or messianic zeal on the other that drive the settlement enterprise. In the absence of both of these, Israelis would find answers to their genuine housing needs not in the wilds of Jabal Mukaber or Beit Safafa.
And actually, let me ask one more question. I know I said that was it. Do you want to just really briefly address what is going on inside the Palestinian neighborhoods? There's been a lot of attention in the States. A lot of American Jews are watching Sheikh Jarrah very, very closely. Shepherd's Hotel was much in the news for a while. People are less familiar with Ras Alamud, Jabal Mukaber, but I mean, these things are always going on. Always bubbling up. So, can you give people just a quick summary of sort of what's going on today on the ground in these neighborhoods where the settlers are sort of penetrating inside the Palestinian areas?
Okay, Laura, you may not like this, but I'm going to begin with some good news. When I started covering this subject in October of 1991. There were about 1,400 settlers in East Jerusalem in the existing Palestinian neighborhoods, inside of them. Muslim quarter elsewhere. We're now 20 years later, and there may be 2,200. When I started covering this, when you were in the consulate on Agron Street, Lara, we counted 70 Jewish families in the Muslim quarter. Today there are 85. So in some ways, I would dare say numerically, we have succeeded. Where have we failed? We haven't gotten them out. We certainly have failed in that. And we haven't stopped them from proceeding. But beyond that, I would say two things are happening. Number one, I am less critical than most of my colleagues on the Israeli left about the dangers to Israeli democracy. And I think we saw that this summer. We've got a very flawed democracy in Israel, but, you know, between you and me, I'm watching your primaries. Yours is not exactly exemplary. But we're a feisty democracy. When you people enter Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah, Israel morphs into a regime. We're arresting children. We're arresting legitimate protest. There is collusion between ideological settlers and the forces of law enforcement. There are the making all national interests, the parks, the archaeologies, subservient to the ideology of the settlers. Israeli democracy is suspended at the entrance to Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. And that's a danger to all of us. One. Two. We are holding on by our fingernails to a national political conflict. I believe that Israel can do a deal with the Abu Mazens and with the Marwan Barghoutis, who didn't get out of prison. We can't do a deal with the true believers of Islamic fundamentalists, but we are putting wind in their sails. I just came today from the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives today looks like a settler evangelical theme park. It is full with pseudo-biblical pilgrimages that are running ramshod over the sites that are dear also to Christians and Muslims. We are, by our own means, transforming this conflict into a combination of holy war, jihad, milchemet mitzvah, Armageddon, second coming, hopefully in that order. That is not about to happen. That is happening, and it is resonating dangerously throughout this new Arab world. If you only talk about the settler activities in terrestrial terms, that's not enough. What is happening within the old city and around the old city is also a game changer.
All right, I just want to clarify that I don't mind Danny starting with good news. I just sometimes think that the bad news actually outweighs the good news on this particular issue. All right, I'm going to go ahead and put this. Right now everyone is in listen-only mode. I'm going to switch this over to Q&A mode, so if people will just hold, bear with me for one moment. You will hear some beeping.
You can put it at the end of the hall, please.
Okay, can I ask everyone to hit star 6 and mute themselves? We can hear everybody now.
Some interference, Laura.
All right, so we are now in Q&A mode. People need to hit star 6 to unmute themselves and ask a question. I have no control over people doing that, so if people chime in at once, I will pick one of the voices I hear and ask everyone else to mute themselves. I would ask that after you ask your question, you put yourself back on mute so we avoid background noise. So I now open it up to the floor.
Lara, this is Sid.
Hi, Sid. It's good to hear you. Go ahead.
I'm a neophyte in the details and infrastructure of West and East Jerusalem, but on 60 Minutes there was a detailed program. All of us are familiar with the archaeological dig that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Some organization trying to prove the history and of Jerusalem with regard to the Jewish people. But most recently I read that Elie Wiesel is on that committee that is trying to prove that point.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about that organization and what Elie Wiesel's role is, if you know?
Yeah, it's a great question. I know very little about Elie Wiesel's role, except that he's lent his name to it, which is a source of considerable concern. When I began my involvement in New Jerusalem on the night between October 9th and October 10th, 1991, when in semi-military fashion settlers took over the first Palestinian houses in Silwan, I was asked by a member of Knesset then to challenge this in the Supreme Court. We more than adequately pointed out the illegalities that were involved in this, but the court backed away from it for reasons that I don't necessarily forgive, but I somewhat understand. The Elad Settler Organization has targeted Silwan as the city of David. It is indeed the city of David. The area of Silwan derives from the Hebrew name Shiloach, which was biblical Jerusalem more than the old city itself. It is the cradle of our civilization, but it is also an existing Palestinian neighborhood, and it is the goal of the Elad organization to reestablish a biblical dominion in this area, to highlight the Jewish narrative in this area, and they have engaged in the past of the displacement of Palestinian families, existing families, based on that ideology. They are among the strongest organizations in the country. Now, when they began this enterprise, they looked like the provisional wing of the IRA and were not terribly popular. They have been using archaeology, national parks, things of that nature.
Hello?
in order to transform themselves.
We can hear. If you're not on mute, we can hear you.
Hello?
Yeah, Danny, go ahead. I just want to tell people on the call, please hit *6 if we can. You need to be on mute. Go ahead, Danny.
In any event, the Allied Settler Organization is the most powerful and influential organization. They focus primarily in the area around the old city, Silwan, Mount of Olives to a certain extent, areas in the visual basin around the old city. And they have used the control of narrative by means of funding exclusively the archaeological excavations, or many of them, in the area, to turn themselves from the provisional wing of the IRA into Girl Scouts selling cookies, apple pie and motherhood. This is... Today, for me, Silwan is ground zero of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. The third intifada may or may not break out. It has already broken out from Silwan. All of the components of the conflict take place in Silwan. It is a territorial conflict. It is a conflict of symbol. It's a conflict of religion. It's a conflict of narrative, all of which are taking place within the shadow of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and sites that are sacred, you know, to Judaism, you know, Hezekiah's Temple and all sorts of things of that nature. I personally will oppose any political agreement between Israelis and Palestinians that does not protect access to and the integrity of a site of such cardinal importance to the Jewish people. On the other hand, I will combat tooth and nail any attempt to use our historical attachments to these areas as a pretext for displacement of Palestinians and a transformation of contemporary Silwan into an extension of the old city. Now, you may be surprised that Elie Wiesel takes a vacation morally when he hits Jerusalem. I am not. Eddie Wiesel has gone on record saying that he has learned since his mother's lullabies that Jerusalem belongs to the Jews. I agree. Jerusalem also belongs to the Jews. It also belongs to the Palestinians. And rumor has it that there may be some Christian and Islamic equities in this town that exist alongside of the Jewish equities. I do not fault Elie Wiesel for seeing the deep Jewish attachment to the city. I fault him for being blind historically, culturally, and morally to the attachment of another people and to other religions to the city.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could you mention something about Gershon Baskin and his current popularity?
Let's take the Gershon Baskin question first, and then Frank, you're next. I don't know who asked the Gershon Baskin question.
Les Kanges.
Go ahead. What was the question?
I wanted to know what your thoughts are about Gershon Baskin and Ikri. They're presumably experts in Jerusalem as well, have been there for quite a while, and now he's gotten notoriety and popularity with the Gilad Shalit exchange.
There is lawyer-client privilege here. I hope Gershon. I like Gershon. I think he does great stuff. Gershon deals with a broad range of issues between Israelis and Palestinians. I don't know how to do what he does because he is a generalist and does it well. I'm just a local guy who deals with the simple issue of Israeli-Palestinian relations in Jerusalem. So usually when Gershon does Jerusalem stuff, I come in and help. And when I need sort of a specialist thing, I go to Gershon. We do overlapping things, but each with a different level of resolution. He's a good guy.
Mm-hmm. Frank, do you want to go ahead?
Okay. Thank you.
Art News here.
Pardon me?
Is Frank Bamberger now?
Frank Bamberger. Hello. And then the Elsa's in the queue. I can hear them.
Danny, can you talk about judicial remedies that might be available, not only within Israel, but on the international forum, or for ICC, ICJ, in order to protect the contiguity of East Jerusalem with Bethlehem and the West Bank? If there are such remedies, are they certain to be disregarded if they're by the Israeli government?
The easy part of this is to talk about the internal judicial remedies. For years I would, go down the street in the center of Jerusalem, and a Supreme Court justice would see me coming and cross over to the other side of the street. Now, I often said, was it something I said, or is it because I'm a bra-burning radical? No, it's because I bring difficult cases. And if hard cases make bad law, judges hate lawyers who bring them bad, hard cases. I very much sympathize with the courts. And you see it in your country. The United States Supreme Court, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't ruled on the legality of detention in Guantanamo, and they never ruled on the legality of the Vietnam War, even though there were very compelling arguments to make in that regard. And there were very compelling arguments made yesterday and the day before yesterday, before the Supreme Court about the legality and illegality of releasing murderers to secure the release of Gilad Shalit. Courts are not built to deal with radioactive issues at the core, the primordial elements of a society. Now, I wouldn't argue this in court if I were pursuing a case at the moment. And I think that the court could do more than it has done in assuring the legality of things that are taken. And I have I've walked out of court steaming, with steam coming out of my ears. But let's put this bluntly. Our salvation will come within the existing system. Israelis rule East Jerusalem unwisely, unfairly, unjustly, not because Zionism is racism or we're stupid. It's because we shouldn't be ruling it in the first place. If I were the mayor of Jerusalem, I would probably rule East Jerusalem as poorly as Nir Barkat for the simple reason that an Israeli can't rule East Jerusalem well. Now, your second question is more difficult for me to answer. At the moment, the recourse, because of the intricacies of international law, are not immediately available to Palestinians. And I, for one, am extremely reluctant to suggest that if only were Israel were more isolated and pilloried in the international community, everything would be okay. No, I still believe that this conflict ends in an agreement and not in brutal coercion of an intransigent Israel. I do not see immediately recourse to international forum that would put these things in effect. Having said that, I think that Israel has enjoyed for far too long on issues like this a suspension of causality, as if Netanyahu can say, all right, in the Bar-Ilan address, I'm willing to have a two-state solution and then do everything on the ground to make sure it will never take place. I'm sorry. You cannot profess support of the two-state solution and act contrary to that. And if you do that, there is a price tag attached. There is not only causality, there is accountability. And I think that a restoration of both causality and accountability to this conflict is something that would be doing a service to Israel. Hopefully this will fall short of proceedings before the International Court of Justice in The Hague. I can't rule that out.
There's a question from Minneapolis.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Mordechai Spector at the American Jewish World.
Is Keith
in Minneapolis
your congressman?
Yes, he is. I know Keith well.
He's the best. He's the best.
Yep. So we're the Jewish newspaper for Minnesota. 4 years ago, I got a tour through Ir Amim of East Jerusalem and saw Nof Zion in Jabal Makaber. It was just going up. And now I see that I'm looking on the web at an ad for this private residential neighborhood in Jerusalem. I wonder what the impact is of this 461-acre settlement in an Arab village.
It's an amazing story. Really, it is. I think it was 2 years ago, a little bit more than 2 years ago. Lara, you'll remember this. One of my friends in London scanned an ad in the Financial Times putting this settlement up for sale. The development company of the settlement was selling it. I'd never seen anything like this before. And it was clear that the settlement was going belly up. And the only interpretation possible was by publishing an ad in the Financial Times of London was that they were looking for a purchaser for this project in the Gulf States or Saudi Arabia. I sent out one of the most surrealistic emails to my friends in the Arab world. Want to buy a second-hand Jewish settlement cheap? There were no buyers. Several months ago, it was put on the auction block in legal proceedings. A Palestinian developer, very credible, was about to buy the property. And in came a Jewish developer with a Jewish Australian high techie. I think the guy that invented eBay, something along those lines, one of these developers. And they bid an enormous amount of money. And they were awarded purchase of this area. I looked at this and said, the numbers don't make sense. No, this can't be sustained. They're not going to be able to hold out. Well, sure enough, they've pulled out. And the fate of this settlement now hangs in the balance. Now, there are probably 40, 50, 60 families out of the potential 400 who've purchased units there. These are folks who were told, you're going to have a stunning view of the Temple Mount, which is 100% correct. So Jews from the United States and France have purchased flats in this area. What they were not told was, guys, you're going to be living in downtown Jabal Mukaber. So this week, the place is full. Next week, it'll be half empty. So in some ways, there's a great drama going on at the moment because we may be witnessing the purchase of an Israeli settlement in East Jerusalem by a Palestinian developer. I want the movie rights to that one.
You also just, I mean, you mentioned this before when you were talking about the different kinds of settlements that work and don't work. Do you want to just mention again why Nafzion has gone bankrupt?
You know, I know the developer of Nafzion. He's been working on this for 30 years. I really like the guy. See, I'm politically incorrect. I also genuinely like people that I vehemently disagree with. And he is in this to make a killing. And he's not driven by ideology. He came to me as long as 10, 12 years ago saying, you bring me a Saudi prince who will buy this area off of me, I'll do it. Now, he has pursued this, but he's hit a brick wall. Israelis won't buy there because it is not backed by massive government planning connecting it to West Jerusalem, and it is not inspired by messianic zeal. So they can't sell, or they're not selling enough at a high enough price to make this an economically viable enterprise. Now, there's another project along these lines not far away. The significance of this is it literally pulls the rug out of the argument, all of this is about natural growth. Now, natural growth is very skewed in Jerusalem in the first place. When a Jewish child is born, it is a simcha. When a Palestinian child is born, it is a demographic problem. But even leaving that aside, if it is not for the artificial life support of massive government centralized planning and development, or the Mashiach, economically driven settlement schemes in East Jerusalem simply don't work.
Do we have any more questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Hey, Art Hughes here.
Okay, Art, go ahead, and then I heard a woman's voice, so Art, and then whoever that was.
Okay.
Hi, Danny.
I agree that Bibi doesn't want to go to negotiations, and I agree he doesn't have any credibility when he says he supports a two-state solution. But what is he looking toward? How does he expect to manage this over the next few years? And what does he see down the road? What in 10 years?
Phoebe? What does Phoebe see 10 years down the road?
Yeah.
Phoebe's horizon usually goes as far as a month. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. That's three levels beyond my pay grade. DB is a masterful tactician of political survival. What he envisages, I certainly don't know. I question as whether he knows. But friends of Israel are to be encouraged to say, hey,
hello.
If you look beyond the horizon of a month or 2 months, Israel is undermining the fabric of its own democracy. It is destroying the two-state solution, which is the sine qua non of the survival and viability of the Zionist enterprise. You are transforming a solvable political conflict into an insoluble. These are all things that I don't see any indication of appearing on the radar of my prime minister, and I say that with regret. Believe me, if Bibi were to give me good cause to praise him, I wouldn't hesitate.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm in New York, Sandra Stein. What you describe is so overwhelming and so clear. Where is the Israeli public? I mean, what degree of protest, what degree of understanding that how horribly destructive this is behavior?
Yeah. You know, I was in your town about a year ago with an Israeli colleague at a small conference in St. John the Divine, is it called, on 125th
yes.
Street?
Yes.
And somebody got up in the audience and said, where is the Israeli left? And my response was, what do you want? We're both here.
But the central part of Israeli, the moderate,
okay.
Middle, intelligent
okay.
part.
Let me put it this way. Part of this has to do with the fact that for the last decade, there has been no place for the positive voices, energies of moderation in Israel to be channeled. The Bush administration had a policy of let them bleed. And the Obama administration came in with high hopes and blinked in all of the wrong places, and now are walking away from this conflict in a way that are going to let us try and keep the two-state solution on life support until circumstances improve. Having said that, you know, I'm a lawyer. I have only filed one legal suit in my entire life in my own name. I sued Mayor Olmert later to become prime minister. Mayor Olmert appeared on Israeli radio and was asked about something that I had said and said, don't believe a word he said. He's an agent of the Palestinian Authority who identifies with the enemy. Now, I'm a reserve major in the Israeli army, and I am an Israeli patriot. And I said, no, I've paid my dues, and I do it willingly and with love. I'm a patriot. Apologize, or I will sue you. He did not apologize. I sued him. And I am one of the few people on the planet who has an abject apology from Mayor Olmert. I'm not sure his wife has one. When Mayor Olmert became prime minister, he adopted policies that are almost identical to my own. He was very close to going the distance, and the reason that it didn't come to fruition was more about the fact that he was dead politically by the time he came up with it. The Israeli left has been marginalized. We have seen signs of life in the social protests in Israel this past summer that have not been translated yet into Israeli-Palestine issues. Having said that, positions that were once anathema, even to Peace Now of 12 years ago, are now being adopted by people like Olmert and Tzipi Livni and Mofaz, who are the right of center in Israeli public opinion. In other words, even if the energies of the Israeli left have been depleted, our positions are now firmly injected in the center and center-right within Israel. They have not yet been translated into a political platform. I am not confident that they will be, but they can be, and that is the work that we have before us.
Laura, this is Jim. Federico, can you hear me?
Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm in Washington, D.C. How are you, Danny? As always, it's most interesting to hear from you, and as usual, you're
how
a great
you
entertainer. Hi, good. I miss you, and it's really great to hear it's great to hear you, not hear all the bad news about Jerusalem. I was particularly upset. By the way, I happen to be an Italian-American Christian with very deep roots in the Jewish community from New York, and even belong to a Jewish fraternity in college. So my sympathy is with the Jewish people in Israel. But, of course, what's going on in Jerusalem now makes me sick, just like it does, I think, all of you. So my thought is this. I'm also an old community organizer. And one cardinal rule of community organization is you need a rallying cry, you need a rallying point to really stimulate a movement. Is it possible that this new settlement in South Jerusalem that I think will spell the end of a two-state solution completely? Palestinians will be devastated by it, particularly that link between Bethlehem and Jerusalem will be cut. Given that, is it possible that we could use that as a rallying cry both over there in Israel and Palestine, as well as over here, to try to get people to focus on the demise of the two-state solution? What's the alternative? A one-state solution or apartheid? So is it possible that we could try to, you know, obviously with the help of people like Laura and, you know, J Street and you know, obviously Arab American and, you know, Christian groups too. It can't be just a Jewish effort. Is it possible that we could use that as a rallying cry and have you as our spokesman?
agree to all of the above except for the last few words.
Oh, okay. I was being a bit facetious, but I can't think of a better one than you.
Okay, let me put it this way. Look, in my personal life during the last week, cognitive dissonance has been working overtime. There has been very little resonance in Israel over these new developments for the simple reason that everything has been focused on Gilad Shalit. Haaretz newspaper, I think, very courageously highlighted this issue, contrary to all of the written and electronic press in Israel. On the other hand, the story of Givat HaMatos has spread throughout Europe and Asia and Africa like wildfire, and it has not passed over North America. I think that there is a potential. Look, I will not speak for. No, I ran into somebody from the Italian consulate in Jerusalem today. They've had a tough time in the last 2 years because they have a problematic prime minister.
The least.
And she courteously pointed out to me that even the Italian government condemned these actions. Huh. If you're losing Berlusconi, you're in trouble.
Right, exactly.
Angela Merkel's credentials as being pro-Israel are absolutely impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
And she is furious over these things. I think that what we are seeing is a critical mass saying the enlightened public opinion and political leaderships of Europe and other places will not countenance running roughshod over the principles of causality and accountability. Now, because of the silliness of the presidential election cycle in the United States, this has largely bypassed North America. But if I'm not mistaken, the laws of gravity still apply in Minneapolis. If the American political leadership continues to rubber stamp such devastating policies of Israel, it is not only Israel that is in danger, but it will be the United States marginalizing itself and following Israel in single file into abject isolation. That is not about to happen. That is already happening. So, yes, I think that there is potential because reason, logic, causality, the lucid arguments are on our side. I think it is probably easier to rally these this kind of discussion in Europe and elsewhere. It is more difficult to do in Washington and Jerusalem, not necessarily in that order.
All right, so we're getting to the 1:30 mark.
Question?
Yeah, let's take one more question. Go ahead, and then I think we're going to call it.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that question and ask whether you have any thoughts about Palestinian strategy with regard to the current situation. You've talked about the danger of another intifada, but to what degree do you see Palestinians thinking about organizing along the lines of the Arab Spring and focusing on the encirclement of Jerusalem in a nonviolent way to draw world attention?
Great question.
it is a great question. I don't know. We are all under the impression, Nepal, of the events of the last 48 hours. Everybody is talking. When I spoke to the person I trust most, a Palestinian deeply ingrained in Palestinian political culture on Saturday, Abu Mazen Mahmoud Abbas was king. After the deal yesterday with Hamas, he's a walking dead man. I would caution against this kind of political manic depression. I actually have been favorably impressed in the way that Abu Mazen has handled things in recent weeks. And I think that he has displayed indications of rising to an historic role and to leading the Palestinian body politic after him. Whether this will survive the current events, which display that Hamas delivers and he doesn't, remains to be seen. I think the messages of the Arab Spring for Israel are very clear, and they are not being heeded well, both within government and outside of it. Well, I've been, in the 20 years that I've been dealing with relations between Israelis and Palestinians in Jerusalem, the message has been, we Israelis are going to buy you Palestinians by giving you social welfare benefits, and we're going to break you by putting our security services on your back. And between the carrot and the stick, you're going to be pretty tame. And that has in large part worked. The message that I hear from the Arab Spring is the period in which Arab societies will be bought and will be broken, whether it's in Tunis, Libya, Egypt, or Syria, is over. We will be engaged. And that is something that I think the Palestinians are already putting to use and very much undermine the current Israeli approach to the conflict. We are not going to buy peace with the Palestinians or with Egypt by economic aid provided by the United States and security cooperation. We will provide that, we will achieve our balance with these countries and with the Palestinians by engaging them. Do I see indications on the Palestinian side that this is being implemented? Yes. Hesitantly, yes. Do I see indications on the Israeli side that we understand that less than I see on the Palestinian side.
All right. So on that note, we are going to call it end of the call. Danny, thank you so much. This was terrific. I know that I learned a lot. I hope other people did as well. I would encourage people to watch check Danny's... Okay, somebody's not on mute because I hear you. Check Danny's website, which is www.t-j.org.il. And I would encourage you very much to come to our website, www.peacenow.org.il. We also have a wealth of information on Jerusalem and a range of other issues. And I want to thank everyone for getting on the call. This call was recorded. That was in the announcement. It will be up online point in the near future, so you can listen to yourselves and listen to Danny again. Thank you very much.
I immediately retract everything I said this evening.
Thank you very much, and hug Sameach.
Thanks, Law. I'm going to call you back later. We'll talk about a follow-up, okay? This
Great.
Is Jim.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night, Danny.